Daniel Feldman, Sunday morning, December 3rd, Congregation Renai Israel, speaking on Jewish perspectives on the death penalty.
Good morning. Welcome. The topic that we chose to discuss this morning is a highly complex one. It's one that actually is inspired somewhat by the Parshas HaShavua, but it'll take us a little while to get up to the connection in the Parshas HaShavua, so that'll be for later, but that was what inspired us to look in this direction. And the topic is one that doesn't have an easy approach. You know, we try to consider the interaction of Jews within the broader society as, let's say, American citizens, and the impact that they have on that society and the role that they have in terms of influencing the path of debate. So it's sometimes difficult to know where to look for sources, where to look for perspectives that are relevant, especially when you deal with a topic like this, a topic such as the death penalty, which has a number of different contexts in which it comes up. It becomes a little bit difficult to know how to apply it properly. So, for example, a topic such as this, there is often citations from Jewish sources, whether it's from the Chumash, whether it's from the Gemara, whether it's from elsewhere, and they attempt to apply this to the American context, which is presumably what we'd want to do in terms of understanding how to partake in this debate, but it's a difficult application. It's a difficult application because, for no other reason, any source, any Jewish source that talks about the death penalty can be in one of at least three contexts, at least three different contexts in which it comes up. We know that the Sanhedrin engaged, or at least theoretically engaged, in applying the death penalty. It's certainly on the books. We know that there is a system of din that applies to all of humanity. It's a topic particularly relevant to this week's Parsha, which seems to be a different system. And in between, within the Jewish system, it could be that there is a concept of execution outside of the normal Sanhedrin structure. And any source that you find, it's important to try to clarify and to try to figure out what context it's coming from and to what extent it can be directly applied or indirectly applied. And it's a highly complex endeavor. And I think if you were to ask the average person in terms of a Jewish perspective on this issue, so the first thing that comes to mind is two sources which seem to be in conflict, or two sets of sources. But on the one hand, we know that the Torah certainly talks about Chiyuv Misa, certainly talks about the death penalty in quite a few places. It's certainly something that exists on the books. Then on the other hand, there is a Mishnah in Maseches Makos that's very well known as well. It's a Mishnah on Dav Zayin, where there is a statement there that a Beis Din and a Sanhedrin that executed once every 7 years is called a Beis Din Chavlanis, is called a bloody Beis Din, an injurious Beis Din. And the MAX opinion in the Mishnah is it's not every 7 years, it's every 70 years. That would be too frequent. That was the opinion of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And then the Mishnah also quotes Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon as saying, if we had been on the Sanhedrin, nobody would ever have been executed. And Rashi explains that to mean that they would have undertaken a very intense process of investigating the Edom. They would have knocked them back and forth so much that they wouldn't have ever been able to come out with a guilty verdict. They would have ensured that there never would have been any execution. So if we take these two sources together, these two sets of sources together, so the perspective that we may come out with is that the Chiyuv Misa is something that was meant to be on the books, was meant to be there as a message, but in practice was very rarely, if ever, applied. Maybe it wasn't meant to be put to practice too much, if at all, and was really meant to be there more as a theoretical concept. That may or may not be the case. That could be true. Maybe it is true, maybe it's not true. But what I'd like to just highlight this morning is that it's a little bit more of a complex discussion to get to that conclusion. So even if that is the conclusion, there is a lot that has to be gone through first, and a lot of it has to do with considering that question that we mentioned before. What's the context of any quotation? Are we talking about the Sanhedrin? Are we talking about the mitzvah that applies to all of humanity? Are we talking about something in between? All of it has to be clarified and then figured out how exactly we can apply things. So just to begin with, to talk about perhaps in a theoretical sense about the question of punishment and what role that plays, both philosophically and practically. So there is a interesting debate, which doesn't sound so interesting on the surface, sounds very boring. It has to do with a question of somewhat limited relevance, apparently. We generally assume that there are 613 mitzvos. Could be that's itself in dispute, but that's popularly assumed, that there are 613 mitzvos. And it's also assumed that Mitzvahs Bezdin, what we refer to here, the idea of Bezdin executing someone, is also a part of the mitzvos HaTorah. So the question is, how many parts? How many mitzvos are involved? And here there is a debate among the Rishonim. On the one hand, you have the view of the Ramban. The Ramban understands that it's all included in one directive, which appears a number of times in the Torah. Ubi'artu hara mikirbecha. If you have a evil influence, whatever that means, you have a negative force within you, you have to get rid of it. Arguing with the Ramban is the Rambam. The Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos has four consecutive mitzvos, where he lists four positive mitzvos of Mises Bezdin. And the reason he comes up with four is because of the four different methods: Skila, Sreifa, Herig, and Chenek. And the third view is the view of the Bahag. The Bahag, which the Rambam disagreed with very strongly, and the Ramban actually defends the Bahag against the attacks of the Rambam, but the Bahag is on the other extreme of the Ramban. The Ramban said one mitzvah, the Bahag listed many mitzvahs. Every single time the Torah says there's a chiyuv misa for something, 30-something times, so the Bahag says that's its own mitzvah. So this seems on the surface like a very boring machlokas. What difference does it make? Right, from whatever law the person committed. Right. So right, and the punishment is a separate. Correct, there would be one mitzvah, an isser to do it. Right.
There's two mitzvahs.
One not to do it, and one to be
mocked.
Correct. So that seems like a boring machlokas. The whole issue of counting mitzvahs in general is a topic of debate, what role it plays in terms of practical halacha. But here especially, okay, so we'll call it one mitzvah, we'll call it four mitzvahs, we'll call it dozens of mitzvahs. Does it make a difference? So perhaps it makes a difference a little bit philosophically, a little bit in terms of understanding what's going on here, that it points to different theories of punishment. The question of what is punishment meant to accomplish. So let's say, for example, to use a mashal from the field of teaching. So let's say teacher is teaching a class, and you have a student who's talking too much during the class. So the teacher throws a student out of class. So why would the teacher do that? I don't think I've ever actually done this. Let's say, so a teacher throws a student out of class. Why would the teacher do that? So one could say, broadly speaking, say three reasons why the teacher would throw somebody out of class. The first reason would be, let's say, for the good of the class. Right, that the teacher can't teach. If this student keeps talking the whole time, keeps distracting, keeps getting in the way, so the teacher is not able to effectively teach. So the teacher has to take the student out of the class. The teacher, for the good of the rest of the class, has to be able to function. Can't function when this person is talking, so therefore he's removed from the class. Second reason could be that it's not necessarily that the teacher has a hard time teaching. I can still teach if this guy's talking. I'm more interesting than he is. That's not the problem. But the problem is I have to throw him out for his own good. That if I let him keep talking in class and nothing happens, so then he's going to keep getting worse and worse. He's going to keep pushing the envelope in terms of his societal rebellion, and he's going to end up being a terrible criminal. And the only way I can save him from that is if I make a statement now, throw him out, and that will all of a sudden turn the tide and he'll grow up to be a wonderful, productive member of society. So that's for the good of the student. It's not necessarily that the rest of the class needs it, but it's for the student's own good. A third reason I might do it, let's say it's not for the good of the class, I can teach, I'm more interesting than he is. And I'm not worried about him either, I'm a substitute teacher, I don't have to worry about his development. So why am I doing it? I'm doing it for the good of the law, for the good of the policy. If I have a sign on the door, no talking in class, and this student can sit there and talk and nothing happens, so then none of the rules mean anything. The rules aren't going to have any power. So if I need the rules to be effective, so then they have to be enforced. Something has to happen to somebody who is going to break the rules. So let's say, on the surface, this gives us three different perspectives which can be extrapolated to three different views about what punishment is meant to accomplish.
So the third category is what we call deterrence?
Not necessarily. The third category could relate to deterrence, but it's really, we'll call it for the good of the law. Basically, we'll summarize the three by saying one is for the good of society, the second is for the good of the criminal, so to speak, and the third is for the good of the law, that the law is not going to be meaningful unless it has some type of system of punishment, some type of system of enforcement, otherwise the whole thing falls away. Deterrence could fit into a number of these. It could fit into, in a sense, it's a broad concept which could be applied to any of these, that society needs to have people punished for their crimes, otherwise they won't continue. Otherwise, they will continue to do them, so deterrence plays a role there. In terms of the good of the individual, so that he should be stopped, but they all overlap with deterrence. Hi.
Interesting that in legal theory, Rostovtsev has summarized exactly these three issues, punitive and restorative, and this is based on history of law, going back to the Middle Ages.
So in terms of the Middle Ages, I think this is what the Rishonim were arguing about. I think it seems to be that...
Selden and others exactly pointed out, he just summarized these three issues.
Okay, and I think it's, in terms of the Middle Ages, I think it's also Maimonides and Nachmanides and Bahag, that they perhaps are alluding to this, that the Ramban is focusing on the good of society, that whatever the details are, whatever the specifics are, it all boils down to one idea. Ubiyarta harab mikirbecha, that you have something dangerous in your midst, whether it's because they are directly endangering others, whether it's because it's a bad influence, whether it's however you want to categorize it, somehow this person is endangering others spiritually or physically, and therefore Biyarta harab mikirbecha kicks in. I sorry. No, I think it does have a correlation. I think it could show up in any one of these versions. It's a little bit of a parallel track. And then there is a whole discussion to what extent it fits in. We'll see how much we can get into that. So it would seem that the Ramban is talking about the good of society, while the Rambam... Rambam takes a little bit of explanation what he's getting at. The Rambam focusing on Skilas, Reifa, Herig, and Chenek is a little bit of a strange place to focus. Because what exactly is the relevance of categorizing things in terms of those four groupings? So the Ramban, on a certain level, is easier to understand. Okay, all punishment basically is going towards the same goal. But here, we're not judging it based on specific averos. We're judging it based on the method of execution. What does it have to do with anything? So the difference between the methods has to do with the severity. One was considered more severe than the next. And therefore, it correlates to a certain level of atonement, that the idea that the sinner requires different levels of atonement. So essentially, what the Rambam is saying is we have four different mitzvos, to give level A atonement, to give level B atonement, level C, level D. Each one is its own idea. So therefore, what's the Rambam focusing on? He's really focusing on, so to speak, the good of the sinner, that the sinner should be atoned, should get a kapara. That's the way he's categorizing this mitzvah. Now, from a perspective of the death penalty, from a secular perspective, so it's very hard to see how that fits into the good of the sinner type of idea. Other types of punishment that are more focused on rehabilitation, perhaps we could see that. But from a religious perspective, we believe there is a world beyond this one, so there is a concept of being atoned in this world and going to the next world. It does make sense, and that seems to be that's what the Rambam is focusing on. While the Bahag, by counting a separate mitzvah for each avera, saying, okay, you violate this avera, there's a correlating mitzvah to punish that avera, that seems to be for the good of the law. That seems to be saying that the law needs to be backed up, that if there is a prohibition on the books, so then that prohibition isn't meaningful unless there's also a punishment on the books, unless there's also something that's going to extract the cost from one who would violate this. Hi.
Not clear to me how you can differentiate Ramban and Bahag on that note. I mean, it seems to be the Ramban that satisfies, Ramban's categorization which satisfies Bahag's, the reasoning we're tripping to Bahag.
No, I think he's focusing on a very different element. It's important to also see that they all overlap with each other. Yeah. Each one, for example, the Ramban certainly acknowledges that there are different levels of kapara involved. Each one's going to agree that the other's goals are relevant.
I understand that.
Right, so the question, what's the focus?
Ramban, Bahag, find.
So I think the Ramban is focused more on protecting society from this negative influence, which is either directly harmful or indirectly harmful, either physically harmful or spiritually harmful. And the Bahag is talking more on a conceptual level, just that the law has to be meaningful, and the law is not going to be meaningful if it doesn't have any system of punishment.
Well, it's not that the Bahag is really talking about the insistence of retributive person killed, therefore he deserves to be killed. And they wanted to debate around Eichmann, for instance.
I don't argue the notion. I don't catch how Ramban could be accused of not saying that.
I think they all agree with each other that each one is going to apply. So again, like the Ramban certainly acknowledges that there are different types of misa. The question is just, what's your main focus? What do you, when you have to categorize it, and you have to put it in the book. So what? How, where do we put it in the bookshelf, essentially? So these levels, they're all there, and this is particularly relevant. This discussion, as we'll see, these different levels are really all relevant to the Sanhedrin context. As we talk about the three contexts, so this idea of Fee of Misa as a mitzvah specifically is relevant specifically there. And you find some interesting ramifications of that in the mix between the two. So for example, the Mishnah says in Sanhedrin that when somebody was going to be executed, so they would give him a drink that was intoxicating so he shouldn't feel the suffering associated, which is a little bit surprising if the whole point of having different levels is to have more severe and less severe punishments. So the idea of then nullifying that with some type of an intoxicant seems to be a little hard to understand, unless we are dealing with different goals here. On the one hand, we need to do one thing vis-a-vis the prisoner, another thing vis-a-vis society, and there are different things coming together which create the package of what's going on.
This whole analysis is an analysis of punishment.
Correct.
And as Professor Zumi pointed out, it's similar in American law, but it doesn't discuss the type of punishment. Okay, we have to punish people, or we have to punish people, but you know, for certain crimes for various reasons. But you throw the student out of class for talking. You don't kill him.
Correct.
So far, we're talking about punishment. We haven't spoken about killing.
Absolutely right. We're very, very early in the stage, right? Just a question: what are we trying to accomplish with various types of punishment? That's what we mentioned. So, for example, talking in a secular context, to say it's for the good of the sinner, capital punishment makes no sense. That only makes sense in a religious context. There's no question. It's a very basic level before getting into the details of it.
It's very interesting that the Bahar, it's in lots of. In other words, in the area of jurisprudence, one of the definitions of the binding law is sanction. That's it. There's no other thing, area that defines a binding legal system. If there is no sanction,
then there's no such thing as the law. If there's no such thing as law, if it's
there's
not,
no such thing as law or binding. It's only sanctions. So that's what the Bahaga is.
It's coming for that. The law has to be supported with something on the books. So that there are other interesting elements of how the Sanhedrin is going to apply. Also, if you say, for example, that it's a mitzvah, so who is relevant to this mitzvah? This is a mitzvah on all of society. This is a mitzvah on the Dayanim. Who is subject to this mitzvah? It's possible that the defendant is also subject to this mitzvah, which is a fascinating idea. You find that in some of the literature. For example, the Kadja Glover Rav has a tshuva about this, about whether or not the defendant who has been judged guilty, is he also a part of the mitzvah? Is he obligated to cooperate? And he assumes that he is. He says he can't kill himself because the whole nature of the onesh is that it has to be imposed upon him, but that he does have a chelek in this mitzvah, which is a fascinating idea. Hi.
Well, doesn't the Rambam say in Hilchos Teshuva that the person standing before execution has to be misvada?
So that's also a major element. So that's for sure true. Also, that the person has to express vidui during that time, which also tells us a little bit something, which also gets to the topic. We'll see if we have time at the end to maybe come to a little bit the question of tshuva. How does tshuva fit in, and should tshuva make a difference? And it seems clear that tshuva not only doesn't save you from being executed, but is considered to be an assumed part of the process, that the person will do tshuva and will still get executed. So that's itself, in terms of the kapara discussion, that we'll maybe see if we have time to have.
I just realized something to differentiate Bahag and Ramban.
Okay.
Also, for any of these three, certainly for Ramban it's not going to work, but to the extent that the non-Misa punishments, does Ramban include in one lump all punishments of Besdin, Misa, Malkos, and that's the extent for Besdin? Would the Bahag say that for...
And the Malkos would also...
An Avela, the Malkos associated, it's a separate mitzvah.
Right, so the Baha'i counts all of this as a separate mitzvah, and that's part of what the Rambam gets so upset about. Because when the Baha'i counts all of the mitzvahs as separate, so the Rambam says, what are you talking about? So you're going to count Malkus as every separate Malkus separately also, yeah. So clearly you don't do that, so why are you distinguishing between Malkus and Misa? And that's where the Ramban
that
comes.
Right,
it's relevant,
it's
right. And that's where the Ramban comes.
Is it a form of punishment, or is it something else called?
Correct. And that's when the Ramban comes in then to defend the Baha'i, even though he's on the opposite extreme, and he says there's a qualitative difference between Misa and Malkus and in terms of how it's derived. Sorry?
That's what you should answer me the first time.
There you go. Okay, so it all plays a role in the discussion. So this question of whether the Narag himself was involved, Menchas Elazar has a tshuva about whether he's permitted to run away. We say that he's also assuming that he's worried at that point about the mitzvah. Is he allowed to save himself? What if he knows that he was unjustly accused? That's a suffix he has about it. To what extent is the process of mitzvah on him? There's some fascinating discussions that all go to this issue of seeing this as a mitzvah per se that has all these different levels and all these different nuances to it. So this is specifically really in the context of the Sanhedrin that you have this whole discussion. Let's say talking specifically about the Sanhedrin as the enforcer of ritual law. So the idea of the Sanhedrin enforcing, for example, a Misan and Mechal Shabbos, the idea that somebody who's violating ritual law is subject to a Chiyuv Misa when that's relevant, and the Sanhedrin's role in that, that's something that seems to tie in with a lot of these goals and with some of the more unique aspects of the Sanhedraic system. So, for example, we know one of the harder things to fit into a philosophy of a working legal system is the idea of Hasra. You know that today, somebody wants to get exonerated, so you hire a fancy lawyer. So in the time of the Sanhedrin, you'd have to hire a fancy lawyer to get executed. It's very difficult to get executed. It's part of what the Mishnah was reflecting. So one of the things that makes it so difficult is the requirement of Hasra, that the person who's going to be executed has to be warned, that there has to be two Edim. The two Edim have to fit all the halachos of being considered kosher Edim, which means they're going to have to be observant Jewish males who are not related to each other, not related to the person involved. And they have to give the person Hasra. They have to beforehand. So this is even harder than a Miranda warning. Sometimes a conviction gets thrown out because the person wasn't warned when he was arrested. Here, this warning has to take place before the crime actually happens. And already you're dealing with a pretty high threshold of complexity. For that to be able to happen, that's already difficult. And then it gets harder because you have to have not only that happen, but the defendant has to accept it. He has to verbally accept this warning. Kabbalah says what we call Yatir Atzmo L'Misa. And of course, that's something the average person who's looking not to get executed is not going to want to do. So that itself makes this, again, a very high threshold of complexity. Now, there was a whole debate. There was an Italian philosopher named Beccaria, Cesare of Beccaria, who lived in the 1700s. He was very influential in many of the founding fathers of the United States, some of whom were very opposed to the death penalty. The debate on the death penalty goes back in America to long before America was a nation. In the 1600s, the mid-1600s, so they were executing witches in Massachusetts, and there was a debate about the death penalty going back then. So it's almost 400 years that this has been argued. Ad Yom Hazeh, this has been a major topic of contention in the United States. So in the 1700s, many of the founding fathers were influenced by Beccaria's writings. So one of the points that he made, he was very anti, he wrote a book called On Crimes and Punishments, and one of the things, this was called in English, at least, I'm sure in Italian had a different title, but one of the things that he advanced to argue against the death penalty is he said he thinks that society doesn't have the right to kill anyone, because his thesis was that the way government works as a whole is that people aggregate together and they give over certain rights to the central authority. So since nobody would ever willingly give over the right to others to kill him, so therefore it's got to be that there was never the right given to the government to kill members of society, therefore the death penalty is inherently immoral. And Kant disagreed with this, and earlier the same argument had been brought up 100 years earlier. Locke and Hobbes had discussed this idea, and the basic approach that Kant took was that it's not the way things work. It's not that we take specific rights and we make a list of them and we hand over a list of specific rights to the central authority, because then no punishment would ever work. No one would agree to be imprisoned either. No one would agree to any punishment that they would officially sign off on. It's that they all get together and invest authority in the central authority, and then whatever the details of that ruling is, so that becomes the functioning of the government. It's not based on the individual saying, okay, here's what you can do to me. You can kill me, you can imprison me, you can give me a ticket, you can fine me. It doesn't work that way, but they all give recognition to the central authority, which then decides how to handle things.
Particularly, that's what Ramban, the same way that this Italian philosopher would never say that anybody would deny his right to kill in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
He'd transfer that to the larger, the aggregate, and that's exactly what Ramban's saying.
So you're saying you're arguing on him based on his own logic.
I don't see how he differentiates.
So you're saying that therefore you could say that he's right still. He's right still that you grant everything to society, but the same way the individual has right to self-defense, even to kill a pursuer, so too society has the right to consider its criminal a pursuer, and it comes out the same way. It could be. Somebody once wrote an article in one of the Israeli journals where he suggested that this model of how punishment works is basically what's reflected in this idea of Yatir Atzmo L'Mitzvah, the idea of the individual accepting the Hasra, that essentially what he's doing is he's saying he submits to the central authority, he submits to the authority of the Sanhedrin, and therefore whatever they do, he recognizes their authority to do. Okay, but whatever it is, this idea of accepting Hasra, of giving Hasra, and accepting Hasra, of course, this makes it all very difficult to actually happen in real life. And then it gets even harder. There's also a requirement that the Hasra be issued toch kedei dibur. So how long is toch kedei dibur? On the outside, it's 9 seconds. It's somewhere between 2, 3, and 9 seconds. So that means that if the Hasra is issued and toch kedei dibur passes, so the Hasra expires. So why does it expire? So it sounds like Rashi and Ksuba suggests that it sounds like that we have to assume, we have to be worried that the individual defendant forgot. It's very hard to believe, right? Very hard to accept such an idea. I think Sosa Choshen has a very hard time.
You reach a certain age.
Forget beforehand. So like Sosa Choshen has a hard time understanding this. What exactly does this mean? You know, it's very hard to believe. You're going to say to a person, "And I just told you, you're not allowed to commit murder." And you know, it was like 30 seconds ago. You think I'm going to remember? So it's hard to mean. Hard to understand. It means literally forgot. There's some who suggest that it means that the person may have reconsidered in between now and then. So now, if he's actually doing it, he's doing it, so to speak, without the Hasra, because the Hasra was on the first thought, now he changed his mind in between and then came back to it. That's a whole discussion. But there are those who suggest, just to mention this point, so Rav Soloveitchik is famous as having explained that the idea of Hasra, the way the Talmud phrases it, that according to one opinion at least, that it's to distinguish between shogeg and mezid. The purpose of Hasra is to establish that the one doing this is doing this intentionally. So we have a much more intense definition of mezid here. This is kind of a hyper mezid. But it doesn't mean that, okay, if you didn't know this was wrong, you're a shogeg, and if you knew it was wrong, you're a mezid. It means that in order to execute somebody, we need a level of mezid that's above and beyond. That it means that we need to know, not only that you're aware, but if I ask you, didn't you know this is wrong? You say, you know what, now that you mention it, I remember hearing something about that a minute and a half ago. Once upon a time I learned about this. But the purpose of Hasra is to establish that the individual has this in his active consciousness right now. But right now he's thinking about the fact that this is prohibited and that it has all of this punishment associated with it, and he's doing it even so. As I believe the language the Rav used, if I'm told correctly, is that you have to figure out at Heichan hu poreik ol, to what extent is this person so rebellious, is he so defiant, that he's willing to commit this transgression while actively thinking about it in his active consciousness. So then that's the kind of person, as others have explained, has reached a level of incorrigibility that, okay, maybe perhaps execution is the only way to deal with such a person. But somebody who's anything below that, so maybe we're not necessarily dealing with the same kind of an issue. Hi.
I think I need clarification of what precisely is meant by Hasra, and more important, what's precisely meant by Kabbalah.
But they had to say, yes, I know this, and the Kabbalah part, yes, I know this, and I'm still going to do it, afilu hachi. And the Hasra, there was a whole debate in the Rishonim, how much you have to say. Do you have to say that what you're doing is prohibited and is subject to punishment? Do you have to be more specific about it? Do you have to identify what exactly they're violating? Do you have to go into even more detail?
Kabbalah is what we typically hear is afilu hachi.
Basically, yeah. that they say, I recognize this, I accept it, and I'm still doing it. So the way the Rav understood it, this idea of forgetting, it doesn't mean forgetting like you don't know at all that this is wrong. It means that you're not thinking about it at this moment. It's not in your active consciousness. That in order to execute somebody, we require, exactly, you have to hire a very expensive lawyer to get executed in the Sanhedrin. The average person would not be able to pull it off. The average person would probably get something wrong.
Well, so what's known as Ashara, you have to mention a specific place, mm-hmm. part of Hasra.
That's part, yeah, that's all part of the instruction. You're trying to get it very specific. So this idea reflects also the fact that Sanhedrin has a very different structure than, let's say, for example, the American legal system. European countries also have a different structure. Every country has a different structure than every other country, but it's a complicated picture. But, for example, let's say, just to use the American system and the Sanhedrin, so we're dealing with very different structures. All the different players have different parts. So, for example, the Dayanim, the Sanhedrin, so they're playing multiple roles. They are really the judges and the jury, because they're ultimately going to vote on what happens. And they are also the defense attorney. It's also, and the prosecutors. It's their job to make the arguments both directions and to make the defense arguments. And the Eidim are, in a sense, also prosecutors. The Eidim are supposed to come and make the case, not just answer questions, but essentially make the case that the person is guilty. And then they're also supposed to be the executioners, according to the Torah. They're supposed to be the main players in terms of carrying out the punishment. So this is very different than, let's say, the American system, where you have the judge is the judge. He's not the jury, for the most part, unless that's the way you want to do it. The jury is a separate body, and then there's a different person who's playing the role of prosecutor and the defense attorney and adversarial system separate from the judges. And the witnesses are tools of the defense and the prosecution. It's really a whole different system. So the idea that the judges also play advocate roles also have to be there as a defense and as prosecution. Defense especially leads to some fascinating halacha. So for example, there is a rule of ein ed naaseh dayan, that if a person witnesses a crime take place, let's say somebody sees somebody else kill somebody, so then that person cannot also serve on the Sanhedrin that would execute that person. So you might say that's understandable, okay, we need to keep a certain separation among the roles here, but it's fascinating that the way some of the Rishonim explain the idea that the dayan a person cannot be a dayan if he was an aide, is because since part of his job is to argue in defense of the defendant, so he's going to have a hard time doing that if he actually saw the murder. So since we need him to be able to enthusiastically argue in defense of this person, if he saw it happen, it's going to be harder, so therefore that's why he was disqualified as a judge. And we also know this is a very striking halacha, it's very well known, also very different than, let's say, in the American system. So, if let's say, at least in a capital situation, you'd need a unanimous jury in order to convict someone. But in the case of the Sanhedrin, we have the opposite, that a Sanhedrin shiro kulo chova, that if Sanhedrin decides they're all unanimous, this person is guilty, so then that doesn't work. You can't convict based on that. And one of the explanations there as well is that since we need Dayanim advocating on behalf of the defendant, so if they're all voting guilty, so then nobody's arguing on his behalf, so then that's again something that's lacking in the system, and that's again indicative of a very different type of system. So all of that brings us in some fascinating directions. And all of that is relevant specifically to the Sanhedrin dealing, again, let's say, in a ritual context. So while that may be comforting if we're concerned about the unjust executions and all of these safeguards being in place to prevent that from happening, on the other hand, it could be very scary living in such a society if you then are going to worry that people will be wantonly committing crimes and committing murders, and there's essentially nothing that can happen to them because, again, they're not all going to hire fancy lawyers who are going to make sure they get convicted. So it's not the average person is going to figure out that it's pretty easy to evade execution in this system, and then what happens? So we have no control over that, we have no ability to address that, so that's not necessarily the case. It seems to be generally agreed that there's another system, that the Sanhedrin also functions in a different way, and maybe not exclusively the Sanhedrin, they probably shared this authority with the government, with the Melech, the Mishpat HaMelech, the idea that the king has the authority, which again, maybe he shared with the Sanhedrin, to enforce safety, to protect the public. And that's the idea known as Mishpat HaMelech. The Ran has a drasha about this, where he talks about this at length. But the idea also, which the Mishnah expresses, says, Shamati, it sounds like it's a rumor, and I heard, Shamati, Shebezdin Makrin Va'onshin Shalom Adin, that Bezdin also has the ability to give punishments, apparently, as the Rishonim understand, maybe up to and including execution, even extra legally, outside of the basic structures of the rules that we've seen for the Sanhedrin, if they feel society is in danger, if somebody is able to prey on other people because no one's stopping him because he's not accepting Hasra, so then the Bezdin and the king, whoever is holding this authority, has the ability to do what's necessary. Hi.
The concept is that extra legal, the halachic concept of Moridim Vein Mali.
That's part of it as well, right? And the keeper.
Is it extra legal or it is within halachic?
Right, so that's also a discussion. So, for example, the Mishnah talks about the keeper, not the modern day keeper, but the cell in which they would put a murderer, let's say. They had a way of locking up somebody, although it wasn't in the sense of imprisonment as we have today. The whole discussion that Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva about whether or not there's a concept of imprisonment in halacha. You know, there's a couple of examples in the Torah. So Yosef was in jail. You know, is this something that we have as a method of punishment, or is it something else? That's a debate. There were those who felt there is no model of imprisonment as punishment in the halachic system, but the Mishnah does talk about this type of imprisonment that they would do, say, murderers, where ultimately, however it would happen, the prisoner would die, although maybe specifically that some of the Rishonim explained that was an indirect way of them dying because they didn't have the authority to actually physically kill people. So that's a whole discussion whether that's an example of this or an example of something outside of this, but somehow they had a way of protecting society even when it didn't necessarily conform to the details that we've seen in terms of the ritual context. So the idea of Mishpat HaMelech, of the Sanhedrin, one or the other, or together, working as a protector of society, doing what's necessary in order to prevent people from killing each other, prevent people from hurting each other, so that there is a basis for as well. And that seems to be a separate system. That seems to be a whole different track. And so for a long time, this was not really relevant. We didn't have a structure in which this came up. Until came 1948, so then it became a discussion again. So now that you're going to have a Jewish government, so how should a Jewish government treat its criminals? Should there be a death penalty in Israel? Is this something that is appropriate philosophically, legally? Is this something that should be reinvoked? So this was a major debate, and the rabbinate at the time was consulted, and other rabbinical figures were consulted, and what seems to emerge, and there's some back and forth, what seems to emerge is the general consensus was basically, first of all, to act as a Sanhedrin, that we don't have yet, but perhaps to act as a Mishpat HaMelech, to act as a Jewish government protecting its populace. So on the surface, that seems to apply. However, to go so far as to execute people, so many of the rabbinical opinions at the time maintained that we don't have that authority, because we'd only have that authority if it was absolutely necessary to protect society. But if we have now prisons, if we have the way to keep people in prison for life, so perhaps that's equally effective. Again, that's obviously debatable, but if the perception is that this is going to protect society from the dangers of criminals who would otherwise be free, so then the opinion at the time was that the death penalty is not warranted because society can be protected without it, and therefore the decision, which continues to be controversial ad yom hazeh, is that somebody mentioned Eichmann before, it's only used for Nazi war criminals. Other than that, they don't have the death penalty for anything else, just Nazi war criminals, but not for other types of murderers or any other crime.
That last set of examples really begs differentiate between Jewish and non-Jewish
offenders or systems? Not necessarily.
I mean, when you said to protect society, because we have ways other than that,
right? So, but why?
What happened recently? Certainly.
So, as I mentioned, the controversy, the Ad Yom HaZeh, whether it's a still wise move, one could make the case that whether or not you can effectively, I don't know if it's a question of Jewish or non-Jewish, but the political factors involved of then having the question of what do you do with people who are in jail and potentially can be released under other circumstances. So that does reevaluate the whole question of whether it's effective in terms of protecting society. So I mentioned it's controversial, Ad Yom HaZeh, whether or not that's true. But
I'm
that was
asking whether it's effective. I'm asking you whether,
but that is the question,
whatever standards you have,
right,
apply equally, or do you have two separate sets of standards?
I don't think it's a question of who the defendant is. I think it has to be, or it's not a question whether they're Jewish or not. It's a question of some of the political realities that choosing not to execute then opens up other avenues which may be dangerous, and then is society protected the same way? So I think that comes up. But in terms of distinguishing between Jews and non-Jews. So it's not so much a question of who the defendant is, but there is a question of different systems. So let's say who is running the show, who is enforcing the system. So we talk about a non-Jewish system, so it's clear that there is a system of din that is applicable as well. There is mitzvah sheva, mitzvah b'nei noach. There is a concept of mitzvot that apply to all of humanity, and one of those mitzvot is only one positive mitzvah on that list. There's six prohibitions, and the one positive mitzvah is the mitzvah of din. So what exactly does that mean, the mitzvah of din? So Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, which derives this from Psukim, maybe in Parshas Bereishis, maybe in Parshas Noach. But what exactly does this mean as a practical principle? So that was the big debate, which is what's relevant to this week's Parsha. So that's how it took us till now to get to this week's Parsha. But that's where it comes from. It's a very unusual debate between the Rambam and the Ramban. It's unusual because everything is not where you'd expect it to be. So you don't look to the Rambam and the Mishnah Torah usually to find interpretations of what happens in Chumash. Although you do find it, actually find it a couple times in Sefer Bereishis, but you happen to find it specifically in this week's parasha, that we know that there is the episode where Shimon and Levi essentially execute the city of Shechem, and the Rambam explains why did they do this. So the Rambam understands that this is a function of the mitzvah of din, that his understanding of the mitzvah of din is that in addition to the six prohibitions, so society has to put into place a system to punish the six prohibitions. So therefore, the city of Shechem had an obligation, as far as the mitzvah of din is concerned, to enforce the six prohibitions, and they failed to do that. Somewhat evocative of what, not exactly, but somewhat evocative of what President Bush said after 9/11 about harboring a terrorist being considered a terrorist. So essentially, that seems to be the way the Rambam understood the situation, that failing to punish the criminals in their midst made the whole city guilty, and therefore, because of the obligation of din, that's why they were executed. So this was a controversial idea, and the Ramban disagrees. The Ramban in his commentary to Chumash in this week's Parsha. So it's not we would normally see him necessarily going into a big halachic explanation, but again, everything is out of place here. So the Rambam's explaining Chumash in Mishnah Torah, and the Ramban is then therefore responding and talking about halacha in his commentary to Chumash. And the Ramban says that he doesn't think this is correct on a number of levels. He says, first of all, the idea that there be a chi of misa for a bitul aseh, so the parallels the Jewish system. The Jewish system, we normally don't have punishments for failing to do something. The punishments are more for committing transgressions. So too here, even though you may say that there's a death penalty for violating the Noahide Code, but that's not true for failing to do something, for failing to enforce it, which is what the Rambam was alleging here. And says also, it just doesn't seem to flow with the story, that if this was basically what the Rambam is saying, is that Shimon and Levi were right in what they did, and that's not the way it comes out, that if they were right, so then Yaakov should have done it himself. And if you'll say that Yaakov was too old or he was afraid, so then he certainly shouldn't have been angry at them, but he's clearly angry at them, and that comes up again later in Parshas Vayechi. So clearly the approach seems to be that Yaakov disagrees and that he's the authority here, so it doesn't seem to be that the Torah is supporting what Shimon and Levi did. Hi.
On this Rambam, which is very problematic, the Rambam was saying that because there was no system of din, everybody was chayav misa in Shechem.
Because they didn't enforce din. Right.
However, what was the sin? The sin wasn't one of the Zion mitzvot of the name.
He calls it gezel.
There was kidnapping, but none of these are yisur. So give us the Rambam's understanding.
He calls it gezel, and kidnapping is a form of stealing. As we know, actually, the Saras Hadibros is probably talking about a little signal that we, majority of you, is that's actually not talking about stealing property, it's talking about stealing people. So his understanding, he uses the word gezel there, if I remember correctly, and that's what they failed to enforce. And it provokes a whole interesting discussion among other Rishonim talking about how other details could perhaps fit into this, that why they took their money also. Maybe the money was a knas. It's a whole discussion about Kim Leib the Rabbi Mine, so how could you execute the men take their money? The question why you killed only the men, maybe because only the men were chayev and din, maybe they were the only potential judges. It's a whole back and forth. But at other levels, why it's problematic, and that's why the Ramban thinks, just in terms of the text, that it doesn't seem to be that they did the right thing. That's what Yaakov seems to be saying to him, and he comes back and remembers it again in Parshas Vayechi, his basic rebuttal of what they did. So in the context of all of that, he says that he just has a whole different conception of what din means. And it's also perhaps equally problematic, it's very mechudish, that the Ramban understands that essentially din means choshen mishpat, means civil law, and that the code that we have of civil law of dinei mamonis applies to all of humanity, all of the details, the schiras polim and the shomrim, everything. It all applies equally to all of humanity, which is a itself a surprising idea. It's a big chiddush. I remember I once heard Shlomo Fisher speak about this, and he said that if you're going to tell me that you understand this because everything in choshen mishpat is intuitive and you can figure it out, so I'll tell you there are more gzeiros shavas and kal vachomers and bava kama than there are in parah aduma. If you think that it's also obvious, also negative. Figure out, it's not the case. It's, the Ramban is equally surprising in some senses to say that that's what din means. But this is essentially a fundamental debate about what the parameters of this mitzvah of din require.
Where is this
Ramban? Ramban is on the pasuk. The exact pasuk I could find, but it's on the pasuk of the it's in the pasuk somewhere between them killing him, killing the city, and Yaakov's response.
Also, it's not a
It's in Vaishnav. It's in Vaishnav.
We make up all seven in here. I know those two things. Do I understand correctly that those comments attributed to the Rambam about Gezel and such would be his response to Ramban?
Well, he wrote it first, but
I understand that.
Right, that's how he expressed his issue.
So he's in a sense foreseeing the question.
Well, that's how he's explaining his position, that he said that he thinks I think the language from Harei Shechem Gezel, and they didn't punish it. They didn't enforce it. So it's interesting, just there is somewhat of a debate as to which view is correct. The Rama had a tshuva about this, where he traced it to a machlokas in the Gemara. The Chassam Sofer had a tshuva, where he thought they were essentially overlapping, because once you have a prohibition of Gezel, so then you need parameters to define. Gezel is meaningless unless you have a system saying who owns what and what how things work, so you have to have a legal system in order to figure that out. So that's a whole discussion. There is a fascinating tshuva, just to give an example. It was a great posik in B'nai Brak by the name of Rav Nassim Gestetner, who passed away a few months ago, maybe almost a year ago at this point, the author of the Tshuvas Lahoris Nassim. So he has a tshuva where he discusses the following situation. I don't know exactly when it was written, let's say a few decades ago probably. So there was a case between a man and a woman, a husband and wife, that they were arguing over money. The question was whether the money was considered marital property or not. That the woman was a Holocaust survivor, and she was receiving reparations from the German government. And the husband was claiming rights to that money as marital property, and she was arguing. So the question is, how do we classify this money? The idea that she's receiving reparations from the German government, how exactly do you classify that? So he has a tshuva where he tries to figure out how we should view these types of payments. So he says, on the one hand, in the Torah, we seem to have such an idea. We have an idea of demei chavala, that somebody who wounds somebody, there are certain payments which theoretically are relevant. So one could argue, if we follow the Ramban's philosophy of the mitzvah of din, that the Torah's civil laws, the choshen mishpat, is applicable to all of humanity. So then you could make a case that there is a chiyuv of demei chavala, and demei chavala would be personal money. That'd be money that's the wife's property, it's not the husband's property at all. As opposed to if it was, let's say, not classifiable in a halachic category, then it might be seen as a gift, which may have a different status. So he took first the perspective that basically it seems to follow the category of demei chavala as a reflection of the Ramban's understanding that that's what the mitzvah of din would suggest, that this system applies to all of humanity. But then he goes on to say that, but hold on a second, maybe you'll say that's not going to work, because, okay, maybe there is a chiv of Demei Chavala, but who has to pay the Demei Chavala? Presumably the Nazis have to pay the Demei Chavala, but the people who are paying now a few decades later, that's not the Nazis, it's a new government, the German government of whenever it was, the 60s or 70s, so that's a later government that replaced the Nazi government. They're not the ones who perpetrated this crime. So then he suggests that this is still an obligation because of the Rambam. So that's where the Rambam comes in. He combines the two. Says that the Rambam's idea that it's the obligation of society to enforce everything, so therefore, even though they're not the perpetrators in terms of their governmental role, so he combines the Rambam and the Ramban's position to say, therefore, there is a Dmei Chavala obligation, which even those who are not the perpetrators but are the governmental system are obligated to uphold, and therefore he concludes that it's her personal property, that it's considered to be Dmei Chavala, and he paskin in favor of the wife based on that analysis. It's a fascinating point. So to get a lot of details about this whole discussion of the mitzvah of din, how it applies, how it doesn't apply, but it's a little bit difficult because it swings the whole death penalty question into a different direction. Because if we look at the mitzvah of B'nai Noach, So there, the chiyuv of din, we find that showing up all over the place. The Gemara says, "Asarasan zohi misasan," that there is a punishment of misa for all of the signing of Shmei Noach. So machlokes around the Ramban, whether it's six or seven, whether it's a council asay also. So machlokes whether it's six or seven, but at least for six of them, so you have the chiyuv misa all over the place. So that would be a tremendous chumrah. Would you find anyone saying that? Yes, not only should we advocate for the death penalty in America, but we should advocate for it all over the place for all the thieves, everybody who violates any one of the six Bnei Noach should be subject to death penalty. So you don't find too many people saying that. That seems to be a very far extreme in the other direction. So far we're trying to figure out what's relevant. It would seem that the system of din by Bnei Noach would be the most relevant, but that would swing us most into the chumrah direction. You'd have a death penalty all over the place. So is that the case? Doesn't seem to be the case. The question is, why not? So you have part of an answer. It doesn't help for everything, but part of an answer was suggested by the Chelkes Yoav. The Chelkes Yoav was one of the students of the Sochet Shavu Rebbe of Yavnei Nezer. So the Chelkes Yoav has a responsa called Chelkes Yoav, and then in the back he has what was a three-page appendix, which then became a huge, massive three-volume work. That he has a section called Kavod de Kashesa. Kavod de Kashesa, Kavod in Gematria Kuf Beis Aleph is 103. So he has 103 questions, 103 questions which he thinks keep you up at night. There's no possible answer to any of these 103 questions. So, of course, to say something like that, you're challenging everybody to respond. So many Sfarim came out later, Sfarim that were written as responses to the 103 questions. Somebody once wrote a sefer called the Kavod de Nichusa, 103 answers to the 103 questions. Others wrote responses to some of them. So then more recently, Rabbi David Mandelbaum is the author of many, very, very prolific author. So he generated a set called the Kavod de Kashesa, three massive volumes, where he collected everything that was ever written in terms of answering these questions, and he generated a lot of answers on his own by writing letters to contemporary Gedolim saying, you know, have any Kavod de Kashesa you want to answer, and published all these volumes. So in the Kavod de Kashesa, the Chelkes Yoav talks about some of these issues, and he suggests as an approach that maybe you could say as follows, but it's only going to answer a little bit, that maybe you have, if you're dealing with interpersonal law, you're dealing with mitzvos ben adam l'chaveiro, so then maybe you could say that there is the death penalty until a different system is put into place. That if the government says, the U.S. government says, we're not going to execute people, we're going to put people in jail if somebody steals, so then that's as if society got together as a whole and was mochel and said, okay, we have a right to execute all our thieves, but we decided instead we want to put them in jail, so therefore there was a societal mechila, and therefore maybe that could address it to some extent. So had there not been any laws, had there not been any U.S. government putting the rules into place saying this is what we do to thieves, so then it could have been the death penalty would be relevant. But because now there is a different system, so that supplants it. So it doesn't answer everything. Maybe it helps a little bit. What's a little more helpful is an approach that I have to introduce with the following. Remember many years ago, I guess this must have gone back about, this was four gubernatorial administrations ago, so this is about 16 years ago, around the time when Governor Pataki first became governor. So that would be already five administrations ago. So yeah, that's a while ago. So I'm dating myself. So I remember seeing in the newsstand, there was an intriguing cover, I think it was New York Magazine. It was an intriguing cover story, clearly a very scientific study that they did. They figured out who the 100 smartest New Yorkers were. So it's clearly going to be intrigued who's the 100 smartest New Yorkers. So I opened up the... Sorry? So they found you had to pick somebody. So we see it comes up with a complicated list. So out of the 100 smartest New Yorkers, there were two who were associated at the time with Yeshiva University. So one of the 100 smartest New Yorkers was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. There were just two problems. Right, so there were two problems with him. So the two problems is that, one is that he wasn't a New Yorker. He lived in Chicago. He used to commute to New York, but he wasn't really a New Yorker. And second is the picture that they had for him was a picture of the Rav. So they had the wrong picture. But other than that, it was still nice to see.
The author was not one of the 100.
Right, exactly. Right, it's a little bit embarrassing for the magazine. But all those flaws aside, it was still nice to see Ron Soloveitchik here in New York Magazine advocated as one of the 100 smartest New Yorkers. So you can understand it's only a magazine, it's not a book, so they don't have the ability to thoroughly prove how all of these people were the 100 smartest New Yorkers. So they had to do it very bekitzer. So for each one of these 100 people, so they have a picture of the person's brother, and then a little quote, or I guess that was, maybe it was pictures of others, but they have a quote there to show just how smart they were. Just one quote, they couldn't have a whole thing. So what was the quote that they had for Ivan Soloveitchik? So Ivan Soloveitchik was a political liberal. And the quote that they had for him is, again, Pataki had just been elected governor. And if you recall, so one of the main platforms that he ran on was a pro-death penalty platform, that Governor Cuomo I had been very opposed to the death penalty. And Pataki argued the other way, and that was probably a big factor in his election. So the quote from Ivan Soloveitchik was his exhortation to be very careful with the death penalty, that he's saying Governor Pataki should take great care in how he applies the death penalty. And he says that the Talmud says that a Sanhedrin that killed every 70 years would be called a bloody Sanhedrin. Governor Pataki should be careful that New York shouldn't be a bloody state. So you might think, one might argue, that this kind of contradicts what we've been saying till now, that we're saying till now that there are different contexts and we have to know which context is relevant. And that quotation was in the first context, the context of the Sanhedrin, and presumably New York State government is not subject to the rules of the Sanhedrin, is probably subject to the rules of the mitzvah of Din. So why would Rav Aaron be applying this Mishnah to Pataki? So in order to find out the answer to that, so we have a L'shitaso, that we have to read Rav Aaron Soloveitchik quoted in an even better magazine, the Beis Yitzchak Journal, the Talmudical Journal of Yeshiva University. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote an article there many years ago, where he explained basically his thesis of how the death penalty works in the mitzvah of din, in the system of din. What exactly does it mean when we say asarasan zohi misasan, that there is a system of misa for all of these averas? So he explains as follows. So we started off by talking about the different possible theories of what misa is meant to accomplish, different theories of punishment. And we noted that really that's the Sanhedrin context. That's the guy, that's probably where those theories all operate together. In terms of the mitzvah of din, so Rav Aaron maintains there that that's all about one thing. That's all about ordering society, keeping society from killing each other. As the Mishnah says, Shadavin for the well-being of the government, Shal Mali Moro, Yisrael Chaim Bolo, that if the government wasn't stepping in, people would eat each other alive. So the function of the din by Bnei Noach is that people shouldn't be protected from each other, people shouldn't be killing each other. So that's the only focus. It's not about kapara, that's not the job of the din of Bnei Noach, it's not there to effect atonement. It's not there to make a point. It's there for a very practical purpose. So if that's the case, the way he understands the idea of asarasan zohi misasan, that there is a misas bezdin, so he understands that to mean that the Noahide judge, that the non-Jewish judge, has the discretion to do what he needs to in order to protect society, up to and including execution. So if the judge decides that somebody needs to be executed in order to protect society, so he's not a murderer, that's not a violation of one of the other six averos, the idea of Ritzicha, that's not a violation. He has that authority, that's part of what din means. However, he has the discretion not to do that. It's essentially a reflection of the upper limit, that he has the right to do what's necessary in order to protect society. So if we understand it that way, so then it makes a lot more sense to try to understand what he means when he had his quote in New York Magazine. That what he's essentially saying is that Governor Pataki, the New York State government, has the right to punish criminals, has the right to execute criminals if that's what they deem necessary. But they also have discretion to figure out what's best to do. And in terms of figuring out that discretion, in terms of knowing what to do, so then presumably there are philosophical questions at stake, there are conceptual questions at stake, and then I have the right to draw on the tradition from various places to try to figure out how that discretion should be applied. So I could quote the Mishnah in Makkos, which says the Sanhedrin would kill once every 70 years. So is the Sanhedrin the New York State government? No, it's a completely different system. But perhaps there is a message there, perhaps there is a statement of how careful they were, perhaps we could analyze why they were so careful and take that consideration into discretion when deciding what to do. And maybe, again, so his particular bent, that would mean that there should be very sparing, if any, usage of the execution system of capital punishment in the New York State system. And this somewhat parallels, probably it's the same lumdus that Rav Moshe Feinstein was utilizing. Rav Moshe Feinstein also addressed a New York State governor. He has a tshuva written, I don't know if the recipient of the tshuva is printed in the tshuva, but the tshuva was written to a previous governor of New York State who just passed away, to Hugh Carey. Rav Moshe has the tshuva written to him, where he was apparently asked... Right, and he was very from Catholic. So he was apparently asked to explain the Jewish view on the death penalty. So he doesn't go into the same lumdus, but it seems to be that he agrees, because he doesn't say, well, B'nai Noach, everyone's subject to Chiv Misa, so yeah, kill them all. He doesn't say that. He talks about it being a very delicately applied system based on Cheshbonus. And he takes a little bit more of a, let's say, a more right-wing bent towards the end, says, but if you find that in this generation people are wantonly killing each other and people are at risk, I don't know exactly what year it was written, you know, crime has gone in very different directions in New York over the past few decades, so if you find that society is very much at risk from criminals, so then it is appropriate to execute those who would murder others, those who would endanger others. So on the one hand, he's clearly not taking the view that any violation of the Noahide Code automatically gets the death penalty. That's not what he was saying to the governor of New York. But he was saying that there's a role for it, that it'll depending on your discretion. So it would seem that from the lumdus that's involved, he's probably taking a perspective very similar to what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was articulating, even if in terms of his advice, he was maybe focused on a little bit of a different direction, but it seems to be from a lumdus perspective that it's probably a related point. Hi.
Could you comment on how Besdin's Misa, applied by Besdin, might relate to contemporary morals?
In terms of the effect that it has on society?
Besdin today would be chayav to do sayaf, or would they be required to bow to most of the planets thinking that that's barbaric?
So again, to the situation where you're going to have sayaf is going to be equally... is going to be
whatever.
Right. So you know, how the Sanhedrin would apply itself in the modern day context, it takes so much of a leap to know how things would fall into place in order to get to that point that it would be very hard to try to guess what that would.
But just the first step, is it dismissed out of bounds? Or we're stuck with these four, or is
in terms of that method? Right, that's true. It's what shows you something about the range of applications that exist, right? So yeah, and I think that would be something for the new Sanhedrin to figure out, which again, there's so many steps that have to happen between now and then that it's really hard to try to project. But just that. Hi.
Could you discuss a derivative question, and that is the difference in a capital offense, whether you murder a Jew or murder a non-Jew?
I don't think that has much relevance in this context, because...
Well, has to do with... You know, why is the first case executable and the second not?
Well, executable by who? Right, so that's also a part of the question. So in the system of din, so presumably they're both equally executable. Right. In terms of the system of Sanhedrin, so the Meshech Chachma suggested that really it's worse to kill a non-Jew, and that's why the Maharsha has the expression, right? Lo sagile
bekapara. In terms of practice.
Right. So then, the question is: so in terms of the second stage, whether that would even be the case? So then, in terms of protecting society, how would that be applied? It's all goes back into the only system which there might be any distinction. It goes into the first system and the ritual system, which when dealing with murder already, you're dealing with a complicated structure, because murder is always going to draw upon maybe all three systems. So it's hard to apply that philosophically when practically it has so many complexities to it.
But is there a kind of lumdish svara that Rishonim talked about?
See, you do have...
A in one case and B in another case. Forget about the philosophy of it, just the...
Yeah, the later... And the Meshech Chachma has that, the later approach that goes in the other direction, that he considers it to be more chomer because of the Chil Hashem component. This is therefore the Misa is not going to be effective. That's what the Maharsha has a comment in a different context, why we can't necessarily always say that we have the principle Ein Onshin Min Adin, that we can't go a Kal V'Chomer and say, okay, if you have a Misa here, you have a Misa there. So it's because sometimes something that's more severe doesn't have a punishment specifically, because a punishment is meant to affect the atonement, and maybe you can't affect an atonement more severe transgression. So it's a question which is difficult to deal with abstractly, but abstractly it doesn't have so much relevance, because in terms of the practical system, it's going to be probably system two that's in effect, which wouldn't necessarily make such a distinction. So it's a difficult thing to try to analyze abstractly. Hi.
Looking at the Sanhedrin system, under the Sanhedrin system, it's pretty clear that that capital punishment was very rarely used.
Right.
What lesson do we learn from that? So we have the system. It's based on Torah law. It was the system that was in effect for when the Jews had sovereignty, and so it should be teaching us something about.
I think that was Rav Aaron's point.
Well, I'm trying to see. Is there any other point? Because I don't see any other point.
Well, there's a lot of questions then you could learn. So, for example, we're getting a little short on time. So I'll just mention one other example, but just one other area where you won't come to any conclusions either. But just in terms of looking at some of the literature, so one of the questions that comes up, especially in the American system where it takes so long to execute somebody, so then you're confronted with the question sometimes of should we recognize rehabilitation? The Carla Faye Tucker case, and all kinds of cases that come up. If somebody's on death row for 20 years, so it's very possible for a person to change during that time. So should we recognize repentance? Is that something that should be acknowledged? So in the Sanhedrin system, so there you don't recognize tshuva. That's relevant to what you brought up, that tshuva was implicit, that the was required as part of the process. The person had to confess and still was executed anyway. So it's a good question. Why is that? If we believe, spend all of Elul and Tishrei talking about how we believe in tshuva, and then the system here doesn't allow for tshuva. So that was a discussion that the Joseph Engel had, and that the Yehuda had, and others about why is it that we don't accept tshuva? That on the one hand, maybe it is that really we do accept tshuva, but that everybody would claim tshuva. There's no way to prove it. A person who's on death row is for sure going to maintain that he's done tshuva, so therefore maybe it's not something we could verify, or others suggest that maybe that's the system by its nature. If you're going to say execute anybody, so since everybody would choose tshuva rather than execution, so then that shows you that doesn't seem to allow for it, or maybe those are both the same reason. Maybe it's the same idea that you can't ever prove it. Then what if you have a situation where you could prove it? Let's say somehow the system allows for such, or somebody has time afterwards to act in such a way that shows that he does have a different approach to life. So that's all a complicated question. So then if you have the issue of how should the U.S. government, let's say, apply this principle, so then maybe, like Rav Aaron was saying, that maybe they have the right to look to this extensive literature, where you will find many such things discussed. The question of deterrent also, which was brought up earlier, deterrent is also a complex philosophical question, because when you talk about death penalty as deterrent, so you have to figure out what do you mean. You're deterring the person from doing it beforehand, and you're certainly deterring them from doing it afterhand, because there's very, very little recidivism among people who were executed. So then, presumably, you're talking about deterring others, and the question of is it justified morally to kill one person to deter someone else? And there were many who thought that that was very philosophically problematic. So there's a literature about all of this, and I think presumably what Rav Aaron was saying in that quotation is that one has the right, even one has the obligation, perhaps even within the B'nai Noach system, even when addressing the governor of New York, to look to all of the literature, both the legal and the philosophical literature, to figure out how it should be applied and to incorporate all of that into the discretion. So basically, hi.
Rav Herzog tried to deal with this issue specifically on the question of Matir Atzmo Limitato. I argued that that could not be universally applied because
society would be unprotected.
For instance, somebody that commits suicide by drowning is not denied cura because he regretted. I mean, that's the rationale, because there was enough time for him to change his mind. So therefore, there is not matir atzmo limitato. The same thing, this principle could be invalidated in any case. I mean, matir atzmo limitato is during the hatra'ah, and we are executed in much later.
So therefore, by definition, you have
right.
to...
So it's...
Could be. So basically...
I accepted this argument, therefore...
Yeah, it could be. So we should wrap up a little bit late, but just we started off mentioning that the perspective that many have in dealing with the two broad sources we started off with, that maybe there is a system on the books which was meant to be applied very sparingly, if at all, that might still be true. Maybe that is the way to interpret that disparity, but what we tried to bring out this morning a little bit is that it's a lengthy journey to get to that point, that there's a lot that has to be understood in terms of how to apply the different philosophical and legal concepts that could get us to that conclusion. So I think we'll just quickly review what we spoke about. We mentioned the fact that there are different sources that talk about the Misa and different contexts in which they come up, and to try to apply any of them to broader general society requires an understanding of those contexts. We mentioned the three, the Sanhedrin dealing with ritual law, the Sanhedrin protecting society, and the system of din that we read about in this week's parasha. We talked about three different theories of punishment that correlated to three different theories of how to count the mitzvos of Mises Bezdin, the Ramban counting one, the Ramikar Becha applying to protecting society, the Rambam counting four, Skilas Reifa Harig and Fenik, because of the good of the sinner that he should receive an atonement, and the Baha'i counting many, one for each Chiyuv Misa, representing the idea that we have to back up the law with some type of system of support. And then the suggestion that really that's all in the context of Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin has its own unique mitzvah applications. That's why, for example, there was an intoxicating drink given to the defendant, even though at the same time they were giving different levels of severity, we're still inoculating him from it. And I talked about the question whether it applies to the defendant also as a mitzvah, the question whether he has to participate, even though he's not allowed to kill himself, whether he is obligated not to run away, discussion of the mitzvah Salazar and others. We mentioned that a little bit. And then the question about the fact that the Sanhedrin had certain things in place that made it very unlikely that you'd really be able to execute people, the requirement for Hasra, even more than that, the requirement for Kabbalah Hasra, which we mentioned was connected to the idea of submitting to the will of society, which is the involved in the debate between Beccaria and Kant. And the question also of Tochidei Dibor, and Rav Soloveitchik explaining that we need to establish persons on a certain level of supermazid in order to execute him. Perhaps that's the kind of incorrigibility that's required in order for it to happen. And then we talked about also the different structure that we find in terms of the Sanhedrin versus, let's say, the American legal system, in terms of who the advocates are, who the attorneys are, who the judges, who the jury is, how they all play different roles, and how that explains certain unique halachas in terms of the Sanhedrin. The judges can't be one of the edim because they won't be able to advocate on behalf of the defendant. That's why Sanhedrin shiro kulo chova, if they're all unanimously guilty, so then that doesn't work. All of that reflective of a different type of system. So then the question was, does this leave society vulnerable to murderers and the like, because there's no way to punish them if they're smart enough not to be makabel hasra, for example? Some said that that wasn't the case, that both the government or the melech and the Sanhedrin seem to function also in an extra legal system, that they're able to do what's necessary to protect society. A whole discussion if that was only coexistent with the implementation of death penalty, or whether that also involved other things. The question of how the kippah structure fits into that, for example. And then we talked about how that was brought back up into discussion in the late 40s, early 50s, once the State of Israel was started, the question of how they should treat criminals. Should there be a death penalty in the modern-day Jewish government? And the understanding was that it's not a Sanhedrin. At most, it's about the Jewish government protecting its citizens, which doesn't necessarily, in their understanding, require execution, which is why the decision was made only Nazi war criminals and not others. It continues to be a controversial discussion. And then we talked about the third system, the system of din, which is a machlokas harishonim coming out of this week's parsha, the Rambam understanding that din means that you have to enforce the other six, and that's what the city of Shechem is guilty of failing to do. The Ramban disagreeing on the strength of a number of questions, but mostly the fact that the Torah, through the voice of Yaakov, seems to criticize what they did, and therefore him understanding that then something completely else, that it's a civil system of law, which is parallel to the system of Choshen Mishpat. And then we mentioned the Tshuva of the Laharis Nassan, or of Nassan Gestetner, talking about the question of how to view Nazi war reparations, how to classify the money that's being paid. Should we view it as Dmei Chavala or not, fitting into the Torah's category? So according to the Ramban, you could say that yes, this applies to all of humanity, however it should apply to the perpetrator, not the subsequent government. But then the Rambam comes in to fill in that slot. So that was a suggestion there. So the problem is that if we say that the system of Bnei Noach is the relevant system, so then the problem is we have Chiyuv Misa all over the place, Azaras and Zulim Misasim. I should mention, by the way, that it's also the Chuvas Machne Chaim, I think I mentioned before. He also noted that even if the rules are different, you know, and there are an easier execution, so to speak, but still we have to assume also that there's an obligation of education, that would be part of it, that it's not fair, even if we don't have the same Hasra system, but it's not fair to say anybody's punishable without knowing what's right and what's wrong. So therefore we have to assume that education is also an obligation of din. It's also a part of the story. So then we mentioned that different approaches to dealing with the question of why we don't advocate the death penalty for everything. So we mentioned the Chelkis Yoav, who said that maybe once there's a government in place saying a different punishment, then it's mechila, and therefore you wouldn't necessarily have to impose the death penalty. That only answers some things. I mentioned Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach, which was consistent with his quote in New York Magazine, where he used the Mishnah in Makos to tell Governor Pataki to be very careful in applying the death penalty, and we questioned that doesn't that seem to be a mixture of two systems? So it seems to be explained based on what he wrote in Beis Yitzchak that Azarasa and Zalim Yisasa, the death penalty means that they have the discretion to do what's necessary up to and including execution, but they could also do less, and therefore it makes sense perhaps to point to some of the literature, even in different contexts, to try to extract different philosophical principles that could be applied here. And it seems that Moshe Feinstein agreed theoretically, even if he had a different type of advice, but he also wrote to a New York governor saying something very similar, at least from a Lumdish perspective, that basically it's up to your discretion how to apply it, but it's there for you if you need to protect society in such a way. And then we just gave one example, or one or two examples, of how we could look at the literature to try to figure out some of the questions that comes up. For example, the question of tshuva, so should we allow a defendant to eventually claim he's been rehabilitated and should therefore be exempted from such a punishment? So that we could look to some of the literature which discusses why Mises Beis Din doesn't allow tshuva to reverse the din, and figure out to what extent is that transferred or not transferred to the Noahide system, all of that playing a role in terms of how we partake in this debate and how we apply the different systems to what's relevant to the question. And thank you very much, sir, for keeping so long. So have a fantastic day. Sir? Is the skila, Srefa?